Incidentally, I trust that you've all read Alma to the end. It's long, as you know. And I'm just going to point out some things you may have overlooked. That isn't being patronizing, because I've overlooked them myself for years and years and years, so they're important too. This 10th chapter on now is the legalistic chapter. It's on legalism, on law and lawyers, and it packs a real wallop. It shows immense insight. This was written, remember, in 1829, before Joseph Smith had any of the experience with lawyers. 42 times he was hailed into court. He went through the routine 42 times. They were always bringing him to court. The Americans were just as legalistic as they are today. But remember, this was written before he'd had any of that experience at all. He knew nothing about lawyers, he knew nothing about anything else. He just lived on the farm all his life. So this chapter is really something. We're on the 13th verse now, and they begin to question Amulek using cunning devices with their words. They might find a witness against him. They might deliver him to the judges according to the law, so he'll go to prison. According to the crime, they'd make it all legal, see, which they could make appear to witness against him. That's the whole business for lawyers, to make your side appear, whatever it is. Now that's the art of rhetoric, because that's what Plato says. Remember, that's why he damns it. He says it. Well, the Greeks were shocked by this new art, the art of the lawyer that appeared with Protagoras and Gorgias in the time of Socrates, which makes the worse appear the better reason. That's the skill of rhetoric. You can take either side and make that win. Whether it was good or bad has nothing to do with it. You win the case. That's what you're supposed to do, to make the worse appear the better reason. It shocked everybody. And that's what we have here. But this is way up in it. But of course, it was very old. You're going to have the lawyers and the law's delays forever. But remember, we're in the time of Lehi when they left the old country, and that's when this was stuff reached its peak, actually, with the days of Solomon and so forth, after that. And it was those men who sought to destroy him, and they were lawyers. It's frightening, of course, because these people make the rules as they go. They're the lawyers, they're free to move the goalpost anytime they want, so they always win. If anything makes my blood run cold, it's to get a big envelope saying, Williamson, Johnson, Cohen, MacArthur, and jump. To attorneys at law. I leave it unopened for weeks. It turns out to be a very innocent thing they sent after all. But it's terrifying because they have you in their power, and this is what they're trying to do. Notice they have him in their clutches. They're gonna weave a tangled net to get him here. These liars were learned in all the arts and cunning of the people. Well, that's their business, and you know that Salt Lake City leads the nation in percentage of lawyers. We're the most legalistic people. The Americans are the most legalistic people by far. Japan can get on with about 1,500 lawyers. We turn out 15,000 a year here. It's terrific the way we turn out lawyers. And Salt Lake leads in lawyers, most litigious people. That has to do something with the fraud capital of the world and all that sort of thing. So they began to question Amulek. They might make him cross his words. That's exactly what the lawyer is supposed to do, is make you contradict yourself. And he was on to them, of course. O ye vipers, perverse generation, ye liars, ye are laying the foundations of the devil. If you're laying traps and snares to catch the holy ones of God. That's what a lawyer does. He lays traps and snares here. Well did Mosiah say, remember Mosiah gave them their constitution here. Well did Mosiah say, if the time should come that the voice of the people, remember the voice of the people in Mosiah's constitution, the people chose in local elections, they chose the local judges, and it was the local judges that decided everything after all, because they chose the chief judge, and they could remove him if they wanted to. So the people are responsible, and they will be responsible. That's the whole idea of it. Not that they'll always do right. He says the voice of the people does right more often than not, but if they don't, if you should choose iniquity, then it's your own fault. You made your own choice. That time should come, then you would be ripe for destruction. The ground rules of the promise in the land. There's a very interesting thing you notice. He says, the voice of this people should choose iniquity. He tells us in the 27th verse, it's going to be destroyed by the unrighteousness of your lawyers and your judges. And notice in the next verse how he contrasts it here. The Lord, he's the judge. He says, when the Lord judges, he judges by the voice of his angels. Okay. It's a different thing. The one is by the voice of the people, and the other is by the voice of angel when the Lord judges. You're going to be judged by that. And then he says in the next verse, and he says, the voice of the angels, repent ye, repent ye. Next verse, he says, well does he cry by the voice of his angels. I will come down among my people with equity and justice. See, that's the theme of the whole chapter. Everything's on the theme of equity and justice. A very good study for a law review or something like that. And that's the theme here. If it were not, and this is a theme that we find very often repeated in the Talmud, for example, if it were not for the prayers of the righteous, which are now in the land, that's the only thing that keeps us from sinking right now, the few righteous people, we're drawing an increasingly heavy, making increasingly heavy drafts on rapidly dwindling reserves of righteousness in the land, which is what happens, people always do, just as we do in nature. We improve our means of exploitation as the substance gets less and less. Recently, within the last 5 years, the big fisheries in the North Sea have been famous all through the Middle Ages, at all times, for its tremendous amount of herring. So they have these new electronic devices for finding the schools of herring, and then these new floating fish factories to getting rid of them. They got more efficient at finding them, more efficient at getting rid of them, until about 2 years ago, the last herring disappeared. They got rid of all. So the more efficient they get, the faster they go, and then the time comes, there's no more herring in the in the North Sea. And don't think they haven't exploited, because every nation surrounding it, there are a dozen nations surrounding it, was out doing that. It's the same thing here. We're making increasing drafts on what we have left of virtue that was the one thing that's going to keep us going. And it's, of course, in both cases, it's an exponential increase. The curve goes up like that. So I'll come. If it were not for the prayers of the righteous, and then what would happen? He says, it would be as it was in the days of Noah. Remember, in the days of Noah, then the Lord goes on and says what it is. They bought, they sold, they married, they gave in marriage, they ate, they drank, they did normal things. Business as usual right up until the last minute. In one day, you see, it hit them like that. But he says, this is different. This will be by famine, pestilence, and sword. And of course, they all go together. Then, should the warlike Harry like himself assume the port of Mars while at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment? You see, the three go together, famine, sword, and fire, as Shakespeare puts it. So we have it here, should famine, pestilence, and sword, and they do go together. I remember after World War, I moved a lot around Europe, had to go to places, and the castle at Salzburg, just packed from top to bottom with refugees, Poles and from all over Europe. They all had smallpox was everywhere, and there was cholera everywhere. It was a mess, you see, when these things go on. By famine, pestilence, and sword. What saves them? It is by the prayers of the righteous that ye are spared. Remember that now, and there won't be many of them around for long, you see. And this just made the people mad, of course, really angry. Now the people were really angry with him. This man doth revile. Now this is what's the best defense when you feel guilty as hell, you see? Then you become offensive, then you become indignant, then you're self-righteous. How dare you say such things to us? This man doth revile against our laws that are just and our wise lawyers whom we have selected. So they admit, there's your Oedipus irony again. They admit that it's their responsibility, they're taking it on themselves, the lawyers whom we have selected, just as they said of Jesus, at the trial of Jesus. Remember they said, we have no other king but Caesar, and then crucify him and so forth, and they themselves brought it on themselves. Same thing here. We have selected the lawyers and we'll be responsible there. Then he comes back to them. Wicked and perverse generation, Satan hath got hold upon your hearts. And notice how he does it. No, Satan, again, Shakespeare calls him the fiend that lies like truth. He's the clever lawyer, see. Well, he says, Macbeth says, I begin to doubt the equivocations. Notice the arguments this side and that way, the way he balances them, the way he lays traps and so forth. I begin to doubt the equivocations of the fiend that lies like truth. And he says, who keeps the word of promise to our ear, but breaks it to our hopes, you see. They keep the promise. This is what it says here, where he says, I'm willing to live up to my part of the agreement. But actually, he's playing a trick, you see, when he says that. In the same way, that keeps the word of promise to her. It's legal. That's what it says in the fine print. You should have read the fine print, you see. But breaks it to our hopes. They promise you this. They don't have to promise it because it's not in the fine print. And so this has been going on for a long time. And Amulek is certainly on to them. And how does Satan get that power? This is an interesting thing. The poor people, they're just victimized by Satan. Satan is a ravening lion. He goes along seeking those whom he may destroy, and they have become his helpless victims. Don't fool yourself. Look at this verse here. Why will ye yield yourselves up unto him, that he may have power over you? He won't have power unless you yield yourself up to him. That's what they've done here. There's no power. As Joseph Smith says, Satan cannot force us to sin. God will not force our free will. So we're responsible. The same thing here. That he may have power, but he may, to blind your eyes, notice, it's by deceptions, it blinds you. He's using all the correct answers here about, it's by making us blind, by telling us lies and so forth. Lies like truth, you see. That you will not understand the words that are spoken to you according to their truth. You will understand the words, but not according to their truth. You can twist them. Twisting words, of course, as it says, is the lawyer's business. This is the best defense we have, you see. This is, these outrage their defense. This outrage, they're the untouchables and so forth. And then, have I testified against your law? They said he has. He says, no, you're breaking the law as far as that goes. That's what we're testifying about. I say unto you, the foundation of destruction of this people is beginning to be laid by the unrighteousness of your lawyers and your judges, you see. Which is exactly what Socrates says to his friend Gorgias a long time ago, long before this, you see. When Brother Witzo, when they started making criticisms of Joseph Smith's interpretation of the facsimiles from the Pearl of Great Price, there was a big fuss in 1912 about it, a big hubbub going on, and Brother Witzo, Dr. Witzo had some very pointed questions. He says, in the first place, none of you experts agree on it, none at all. In the second place, none of you had made the slightest attempt, they wouldn't dare, to try to translate a word of this. You wouldn't touch it yourself. All you can agree on is that Joseph Smith must be wrong, as far as that goes. He says, you haven't. So what did the New York Times say? A big scarehead all across the page of New York Times. Mormons revile scholarship. See? Just because he questioned, he made some perfectly good questions. He was a better scholar than any of them, incidentally. But, of course, he was in another field. But he could point out they were trying to be so scientific about it, and they'd done nothing scientific about it. But the reaction was that he was reviling scholarship. The absurdest thing you ever heard of, if there was such a thing as Egyptian Wissenschaft and so forth. So he goes on. And when he said that, he said, now we know this man is a child of the devil, for he's lied unto us, for he has spoken against our law. And now he says that he hasn't spoken against us. This is the idea. This is a typical legal sophistry here. You criticize the lawyer, he criticized them for their lawlessness, of course. But to criticize the lawyers is to revile the law. They're the wise lawyers that we have chosen. And Amulek said he had not criticized the law, but the lawyers, so he had lied when he said he hadn't criticized the law, because he did criticize the lawyers. So they've got him in a trap now. This is typical, you see. He is reviled against our lawyers and our judges. And it was the lawyers who put it into their heart. Joseph Smith's insight into lawyers is very good here. And of course, this is the bottom line, verse 32, the last line of the chapter. The object of these lawyers was to get gain. Are you surprised? The whole thing was money. The bottom line is money. And here it is, bottom line. The object of these lawyers was to get gain, and they got gain according to their employ. Well, you may have followed the paper chase. The main object of all these people that go through all that shenanigans and all that dirty work and so forth is to get themselves connected with big corporations and make a lot of money. This is the way it goes. Brother Welch, who is in our law school over here, has made a very good study on this next chapter about the payment of judges in courting according to the C9. Seems in the ancient court, the judge had to be paid before you were let out of prison. And the judge's pay, it says here, the judge's pay was one C9 a day. And later on it tells us in 2 Nephi 12:26 that you won't come out of prison until you have paid the last C9. They won't let you out until you've paid the judges. And that the judges pay, if nothing else, you see. This is exactly the system we have in the Book of Mormon, as Brother John Welch has pointed out here. And so the law of Mosiah, judges would receive wages according to the time which they labored. The time was, he's going to tell us next, a C9 a day. Some very interesting things. Oh, I forgot something else now. This is silly. The judge received a C9 of gold for a day, or a C9 of silver, which is equal to a C9 of gold. Now, that breaks down the monetary system. Boy, I certainly went off half-cocked this morning. I would have brought this article of Richard Smith's. Richard Smith was a chemistry professor at Harvard. He analyzed this money system and came up with a surprising thing. Now, he tells us here, you see, that their measure, according to the mines, they were not frozen or rigid or unyielding or unrealistic in their monetary system. He says they changed their money to suit the circumstances and the times. Of course, we do every day. Every nation has a different... different monetary units and so forth, which makes a lot of shenanigans for money-making in the market and so forth, the exchange. But here, he says, they made the money their measures according to the minds and circumstances of the people in every generation. Aha, it's the Fed they're fiddling around with now, isn't it? They change the value of the money as they go, the designation, but that's what we do. And this was the, according to the reign of judges, as this was the system established by King Mosiah, since the new constitution is what they'd done. They've adjusted the money. And they adjusted this system, which runs in sevens instead of fives and tens and things, or sixes and twelves, as English does, or the decimal system as we use it. Runs in sevens, and as Richard Smith puts it out, it's the best possible system that could be devised. It uses the least coins for any necessary transaction. For any necessary transaction, if you want to figure out a system that will use a minimum amount of coins, that will save you a lot of trouble, this is the system. It's an almost perfect system which Joseph Smith devised for his Nephites here. The reckoning was this, a C9 of gold. We won't analyze it here. I say I'll try to bring that article next time. And this is the very interesting thing. This hits you very hard here. This is really something. Now, notice, the cenum of silver, now this is the basic... The basic coin, what do you call it? The base of the money here. The cenum of silver was equal to a C9 of gold, and either to a measure of barley. So you measured everything. How much silver would it take to buy a measure of barley? That was the market price of gold, you see, and silver. The amount, well, in this case, the amount of a cenum of silver would buy you a measure of barley, or a C9 of gold would buy you a measure of barley, which is much smaller, of course. But it was barley. Then he says it again. It's just silver this time. A shiblon is half of a cenum, therefore a shiblon of half a measure of barley. Notice things are measured in terms of barley, which is very interesting, you see, because the first Babylonian money, the first Egyptian money, was always the amount of silver necessary to buy a measure of barley. It was always barley. It wasn't wheat, it wasn't emmer wheat or the other grains they had. Barley, it doesn't grow wild in Egypt. It's a very interesting thing, the way emmer wheat does and other things do. But barley was yit, and it was the word for money, and it was what they used. And it was always in terms of barley. It started in Babylonia, supposedly, that the money was the amount of barley. Was a silver standard, but the final decision was how much you could buy with it, of course. That was determined by how much you'd have to pay for a measure of barley. The value of a measure of barley wouldn't change, but the value of the silver would, so you could go into all sorts of speculation. It was just set up for the market. But the fact that it's barley they refer to, I think is very striking, because nobody knew that in Joseph Smith's day. It wasn't until the 1850s that they came along and discovered that, the first thing that came out from in the Babylonian, then later discovered in Egypt, that barley was the standard. Well, anyway, he goes on. Their sole purpose was to get gain, and for that they stirred up the people to riotings, very profitable business. Therefore, they did stir up the people against Alma and Amulek here. And then, the crown and so forth. Well, anyway, stir up the people. Therefore, they did stir up the people. Now, Zizram, this was a man called Zizram. How did we get him first mentioned? Right up here, already. Good old Zizram. Oh, yes, here he is. I was so anxious to get to that bottom line on the 10th chapter, I forgot Brother Zizram here. Zizram was the foremost to accuse Amulek. He was the leader, he being the one most expert among them, having much business to do among the people. There it is. He had associations, he had connections, he was making a lot of money and so forth. Typical liar. You say, back in those days, did they do it exactly the way we're doing it today? I mean, keep up on the Wall Street Journal, it's the very same sort of thing. Yes, they were. I wrote a long article on this, and I taught a course at Berkeley, and a course in ancient rhetoric at Berkeley. And it was a theme. Of course, ancient rhetoric was the training of lawyers for the law schools and the legislative courts. That's the first thing. They worked right together, but you had to be a liar. Well, that's a long story about ancient rhetoric, but it was thoroughly corrupt, and it destroyed the ancient world. It did. And he says the same thing's going to destroy them now. But this Zizram, he was the most expert. Now we refer to him again here. The name is very interesting, Zizram. We'll allow for the mimation on the end. The ends in Book of Mormon regularly end in M and N, just as they do, of course, in early Semitic, they end in N, later Semitic, they end in M. Always, that's the regular ending. Rajulun in Arabic is a man. Nasim in Egypt, in Hebrew, in later form, we put an M on the end of it. But here he has Zizram, good old Zizram. His name's the same as that of Zeser. Zeser, the first, the greatest king of Egypt probably was Zeser, the king of the third dynasty. His name is the same as Jesser, Zeser, or Jesser. It's written both ways, but with Z, Zizram this way, or Jesser. And the same word as Deseret, same word as Deseret. It means holy land, it means red land, it means desert, it means honey, it means all sorts of things, Deseret does. And, well, you put a feminine ending, that's the T on the ending, so meaning the land. Deseret becomes the land. But Jesser is a very common word in Egypt. It means, as I say, it means holy, sacred, set apart. And other things as well. It also means the red country of Egypt and the like. But his name's probably Zizram is probably based on the Egyptian word Jesser, which was a popular name, as far as that goes. But this Zizram was a character anyway, wherever he got his name. And so he begins to argue here. And he puts up the best argument he can. Now Zizram was expert in the devices of the devil, and he says, he sets him up perfectly. Say, will you answer the question which I shall put to you? He has it all set up. He asks a very crude question here. I mean, if he's trying to be subtle, isn't this about as crude as you can get? He says, behold, here are 6 aunties of silver. All these I will give unto you if you'll deny the existence of a supreme being. In front of all those people there, you see. Say, would he accept a bribe as conspicuously as that after his moral tirades and so forth? Well, of course he wouldn't. What's the guy planning to do? Let's just know what he's planning to do, because as Amulek tells him, the later says, I know you have no intention to pay. What he was going to do was to up the ante. This was just like a typical TV game show crowd, and they'd say, take it, take it, take it, get more and more excited. He was going to offer him a fabulous amount, so people thought the guy was crazy for not taking it, whatever he believed, you see, as far as that goes, the corruptibility of the times. And but as Amulek said, I know you weren't going to pay it anyway, so I'm not going to accept it, whatever it is. See, it seems like a rather crude approach, but you can see what he's doing in front of the... He has these people in the palm of his hands. He had much business with the people. He's the most skillful lawyer of the place. He was the top man, you see. And he says, believest thou that there is no God? I say unto you, nay, thou knowest that. Well, he asked him about it. Amulek said, you child of hell, why are you tempting me? Do you know that righteous yieldeth to no such temptations? Even in a prize show here. Now I say unto you, thou knowest there is a God, but thou lovest that lucre more than him. It's the money that had spoiled him, he says. You said to me, behold, here are 6 aunties, which are of great worth, I'll give unto thee, when thou hadst in thy heart to retain them. He says, of course you weren't going to pay me that. He knew he wasn't a servant. And then we come, he starts setting forth the gospel plan. The chapters that follow, now this is the important part of the Book of Mormon. These chapters that follow, 11, 12, 13, good 14 too. If you say the Book of Mormon contains the fullness of the everlasting gospel, this is it. This is the gospel plan, and it's a perfect epitome of the whole thing. It's given by Alma here, and all through here. We're going to get it here. You'll see it goes back to the old law. It goes back to the law of Moses. It has everything in it. So he starts out. Down to 35 here, and as he said, after this question and answer, see, they start cross-examining, and then Amulek is more than a match for him. And then now Zizram said unto the people, you see that you remember this. See, this is it. Remember what he said now. Zizram said again, shall he save his people in their sins? And Amulek answered, said unto him, I say unto you, ye shall not, for it's impossible to deny his word. Now Zizram said, now watch that. We'll catch him on that. For he said that there's one God, yet he hath a son of God shall come. But he shall not save his people, as though he had authority to command God. So he had authority. Notice, he admits the part of in their sins. He just leaves that out. And he says, Don't say in my sins is a typical lawyer question. Answer yes or no. Will he save his people or will he? Well, he won't save them in their sins. I didn't say in their sins. Leave that out. I'm just asking you a question. Answer me yes or no. Will he save his people? And of course, it's a conditioned answer. And this is a very favorite trick of lawyers. Yeah, their tricks are all easy and foolish and transparent. They always work, though, more or less. But he shall not save his people as though he had authority. And then he says, you've lied, you've lied, you lied. For thou sayest that I spake as though I had authority to command God, because, well, this is the way Amulek says, you're the one that lies. I said I spake as though I had authority to command God, because I said he shall not save his people in their sins. I say unto you again that he cannot save them in their sins. See, that's the thing he hadn't mentioned. For I cannot deny his word. Then Zizrom says again unto him, is the Son of God the very eternal Father? Now, this is the crux, you see, of the Christological controversy and everything else. How can he be the Son and the Father again? Here he tells us what he's the Father of. You notice here is what follows here. Father of what? The next verse tells us. It doesn't mention the Son here. Just as Joseph Fielding Smith used to teach that Jesus Christ is our Father because he made possible our physical bodies here, He made possible the resurrection. See, it's through him that the resurrection is possible. And of course, who is it who begets, who brings forth the body? Who is it who begets a person's body? Well, it's your Father. He doesn't beget your spirit, but he brings forth your body and so forth. Well, Jesus Christ, by his work, made the resurrection possible, the literal bringing forth of the flesh. Of course, not flesh and blood, but of the flesh to live eternally after the resurrection. The one who makes that possible is your real Father. He's the Father who made the resurrection possible. And we're not resurrected just as spirits or ghosts, we're resurrected really, you see, as far as that goes. So in that case, he is truly the Father, not just of our spirits, as far as that goes. He isn't never referred to as that, of course. And he says here, is the eternal Father, and Amulek said unto him, yea, he is the very eternal Father of heaven and earth here. He made the whole thing possible. And here, Hebrew 1 and 2 says the same thing. He made possible a physical resurrection. Here we have, and he shall come to the world to redeem his people. See, to redeem something, as we said before, is to bring back somebody home, bring them home again that had been there before. See, redeem is, redemptio, is to buy back again. Redemo is to buy back something that was yours before, got lost, and now you buy it back again. Well, we were with the in the eternities before this. Now we've been separated, and then we go back again. Amulek said unto him, he says here, he shall redeem his people, and these are they that shall have eternal life and none else. The atonement is limited, you notice, but everybody's going to get resurrected. This is an important thing. He makes this out. Therefore, the wicked remain as though there had been no redemption made. He could buy us back. He couldn't buy us back, as I say, if he didn't belong to him at some former time, but were we damned here? Did we separate ourselves from him? Yes, we did. By the fall, we were separated to learn what we have to learn and so forth. How can we be brought back? Well, nevertheless, whether you've been good or bad, all shall rise from the dead, except with loosing the bands of death. The death of Christ shall loose the bands of this temporal death, and all shall be raised from this temporal death. That makes him truly the Father as well as the Son. The death of Christ shall loose the bands of temporal death. That's the death here. So there'll be a physical resurrection here. The spirit and the body shall be reunited again, you see, as they were here during this life, you see. Of course, this is the ultimate question. This is the big one. This is the best answer, the best definition you'll get anywhere of what resurrection is this verse, these two verses here, four of them maybe. The spirit and the body shall be reunited again in perfect form, both limb and joint. Now, there is a very striking thing, because in the last issue of the Egyptian Zeitschrift, the Zeitschrift of Egyptische Sprache, the basic, the fundamental, the clearinghouse of Egyptological stuff, there's a long article by Emma Brunner Trout on this subject. This, both limb and joint, is an Egyptian expression, and it's an interesting thing. The Jews and the Arabs and the Egyptians had no word for body. They just think of the body as a collection of members, you see. The goof, the body, is just the trunk in Hebrew. The jism in Arabic is just the trunk and so forth. The same thing in Egyptian. At, the word from, is simply members. They write it with members and they write three members. That you're just an assemblage of arms, legs, and other members, and joints. the assemblage of members and joints. They always refer to it that way. So a resurrection, they would never use the expression resurrection of the body. They would say the resurrection of the body with its members added and the joints that have to go with the members. It's a peculiar thing because you don't find that in the Bible, you see. This is the interesting thing, where he says the spirit and body shall be, and I say it's a very recent article, just came out, the last issue of the Egyptian Zeitschrift, and the spirit and body shall be reunited again in perfect, what you mean by perfect form? See, they would say, yes, the body could be restored again, but it must have all its limbs, all its joints, and all in working order. That's what he says here. Both limb and joint, say, as if they didn't belong to the Bible, to the body. Well, the Egyptians and the Hebrews and the Greeks before Homer, Homer has no word for body. He uses guia, which means members. And then he uses, there's the other word for torso, but the soma, but the body comes after Homer. It's a very interesting thing. These ancients didn't think of the body as one particular unit. Surprising, isn't it? Then we can divide you up. Even as now we are at this time. Notice he's making it very vivid what's going to happen. And it's limb and joint to be restored in its proper frame, even as we are now at this time, we shall be brought to stand before God, knowing even as we know now, and have a bright recollection of our guilt. We'll be right back to square one. We're back, right back where we are now. And we'll have the bright recollection. It will all come back to us. And we will take up exactly where we leave off, where we left off before, you see. So nothing will be lost. Everything you experienced here, in other words, no experience, no detail of this life is wasted here. It will always be for you or against it, even if you're guilty of wasting time and so on. It will all be with you then. It will all return. So nothing is lost here. Everything is, because everything is recorded. I mean, a good psychologist can get most of it out of you now, okay? Just by hypnotizing you or cross-examining you, so forth. And so it happens. Now, this restoration shall come to all, everybody. Well, you say, well, doesn't that solve the question? That's the big one. What do the Buddhists and the Muslims and so forth have to worry about? They're going to get just as much resurrected as we are. They're going to have as much eternal life as we do. Ah, yes, but it's at the level. And the idea, as he tells us here, is whether we've gained anything while we were here or not. Of course, but they're good people too. Remember, they're righteous people among them, just as there are more wicked Christians and Jews and so forth. If they're all going to be resurrection, that's the only thing that worries most people, is that part of it. It tells us later on that they'll be given the joy to relieve their... 12 and 9 puts them into the picture here. The mysteries of God. Well, let's go on and see what happens here. Not so much as a hair of the head will be lost. Now, that's the expression, because that don't mean we'll have all the hair that was ever cut off and so forth. That would be something. But you recognize how these expressions are, that everything will be as it should be, in its proper and perfect form, which means we'll be very different, you see. I won't suffer from malnutrition there, so I won't be so short, you see, something like that. But everything shall be restored, notice, restored again, to its perfect frame as it is now, or in the body, and shall be brought, be arraigned before the bar of Christ, the Son, and God the Father, and the Holy Spirit, which is one eternal God. There you go again. This is what atonement is, at one. When you're made at one, you are one in that case. You see? One eternal God, to be judged according to their works, whether they be good or whether they be evil, they're going to be at one. Not one person, you see, the one office and calling, which requires one comprehension to comprehend the same things and so forth, as we say, our knowledge becomes more perfect, the knowledge of all of us becomes more alike, you see. As we become more perfect, I say physically we become more alike, as far as that goes. But that's not what our true nature is, the externals. Nevertheless, we have to have this to carry on at another level here, and therefore be raised to an immortal body, that is from death, from the first death, and after that they can die no more. This goes for everybody here. This is really at one-ment coming together. At one-ment of the body and spirit, you bring them together to be one again. They had been separated before, see, and so that's redemption, bringing them back again. And they're one with each other. And incidentally, the members of the body and so forth, Paul makes it very clear. He's following the old Greek tradition when he tells the story, the famous story of Agrippa, the Roman story of Agrippa, about the argument between the head and the stomach. Or can the eye say to the hand, I have no need of thee, and so forth, speaking of them if they were separate members arguing with each other. Paul uses that expression. Is the head more important than the stomach? That's the famous argument of Agrippa and so forth. No part of the body can say that its that the rest can get along without it. It's all one, and you say you can't disappear. But thinking of them as separate members here. But this is different. So they can dynamai, never to be divided, you see. There's your divide. You divide spirit and body, but the people, we divided from each other. The members of the body, and the people from the members of the body, the spirit in the body, the members of the body themselves, and all the rest of us, you see. Never to be divided, their whole becoming spiritual and immortal, they can no more see corruption. Well, that's putting us on a different stage, all right. In that stage, you're going to go on forever. So it's of enormous importance that you get started on the right foot while you're here, because this is where we choose our direction. This is where you get going. That's why it pays to have the gospel. It makes all the difference in the world that the people hear the gospel to know how to prepare for this. Because he's going to tell us this is a time for prepare. Now, when Zizam heard this, he began to tremble, because it was the question he thought couldn't be answered. Alma, seeing that the words of Amulek had silenced Zizam, now Alma gets into the picture now. He went to the heart of the matter, which of course, Zizam had been avoided. He'd been avoiding that one. He wouldn't touch that, as far as it goes. And the, what am I missing here? Under consciousness of his guilt, it all come back to him. With the resurrection, that stops everybody going. They go through all the expository time. You see, the clergy, classical and Protestant Jew, they always talk around it. They'll never come right back to it and make a clear, specific statement like this. You can believe this or reject it, but if there's resurrection, this is what it is, you see. And so stop messing around about it. This being Easter week, you see, they'll talk a lot about the resurrection. Well, it's a spiritual resurrection and so forth. St. Augustine says he believes in an afterlife, but the idea of a resurrection is utterly absurd. You couldn't have flesh resurrection, even Augustine. And he went further. No, he had an opening now, so he followed up. Alma followed up to explain the scriptures beyond, or to unfold the scriptures beyond that which Amulek has done. The words of Alma spake unto Zizram were heard by the people. They were in on the discussion too. Now, as to the subtlety of the devil, now thou seest we know thy plan, as to the subtlety of the devil, to lie and deceive this people, that thou mightest set them against us, to revile us and cast us out. Not having the answer, see, the only excuse for religious people is to be very offensive, very offended and touchy and dangerous. Now this plan of thine adversary, and he has exercised his power over thee. Notice the adversary is the adversary to Zizram as well as he is to us, you see. He's not the friend of those that are following. It's interesting that we cozy up to our adversary, you see, the one who is really our enemy. He is our adversary, and yet we seek to make friends with him and follow him all over the place. He leads us around by the nose because we allow it. The plan of thine adversary, that he has exercised power over thee, you see. And then, this was the snare of the adversary, to bring you into subjection to him. He may circle you about with his change according to the power of his activity. His great ego asserts itself over others as he wants to get you in. And then Zizram began to tremble when Alma spoke. The power was given unto them. They might have the spirit of prophecy, and Zizram began to inquire of them diligently. Well, now, it has been a turning point. He changed his mind. They could see through him, and he knew it. So now he's going to ask some interesting questions, and he becomes a different man. It's very interesting that this top man, this most depraved and so forth, he's going to become a zealous missionary. Surprising what goes on, you see. Zizram began to inquire of him diligently. Once you start asking the questions, that's exactly what we want. The usual thing, you see, is to ask the question and leave before they answer it. We always do that. The people about Book of Mormon and so forth ask very shrewd and pointed questions, but do not wait for an answer. That's the thing to do. Those are the questions we want, but we want to have a chance to answer them and want to go into the mysteries of God. He calls them the mysteries of God. They are laid under strict command that they shall not impart, only according to the portion of the word which he doth grant to the children of men, according to the heed and diligence they give unto him. And that's true of all learning. You learn your math or whatever it is only according to the heed and diligence you give to it. So the Lord's not going to give you something that you haven't paid attention to with heed and diligence, like the 10th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, where the Lord bawls out Oliver Cowdery, think it out in your own mind. You solve the problem, then ask me if the answer is correct. Therefore, he that will harden his heart. Now it keeps using the word harden again here. It's a very interesting thing. All throughout, notice harden his heart in verse 10, harden beginning right in verse 11 here, verse 12, if our hearts were hardened, yea, if ye have hardened our hearts, and so forth. What is this hardening of the heart? It's even more in the rest of the chat. Well, hardening of the arteries or the joints or the drying up of tissue. I know, my age, things start hardening, and that's the point. Become less effective, less workable, and so forth. Intelligence is a quick, it's a lively, it's a mobile, fluid sort of thing. And when it starts to harden, as it does when you become accustomed and so forth, I have to wait 2 and 3 minutes sometimes to remember something which ordinarily I would have remembered instantly, but it always comes, so it doesn't worry me very much. But the four elements, you see, that the ancients talk about, the four humors, they go from earth, water, air, and fire. They become more refined and more active, and it's the fire that is the spiritual. That's the more vivid, the more active, as you know, the molecules move faster. You start out with heavy earth, and the same thing as Shakespeare says, look, Jessica, how the floor of heaven is thick paved o'er with patterns of bright gold, the slightest orb which thou beholdest. And see, sings like an angel, he says. But whilst... see there, that's what I'm telling you about. Hardened up, I should be able to remember that with any trouble. Oh, there's not... Ah, here we go. See, it comes. There's not the slightest orb that thou beholdest, but in its motion like an angel sings, still choiring to the heavenly cherubims. Such music there is in immortal spirits. But whilst this muddy vesture of decay doth grossly close us in, that's this hardening, we cannot hear it. Goes on later and says, the man who has not music in his soul is fit for treason, stratagems, and spoils, the war, you see. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as Erebus. Let no such man be trusted. See this thickening, this densing, the darkening of that goes on with the mind. And that's what he's talking about here. You see, the same sort of thing when he talks about hardening. That's why he uses this word hardening. It's very effective. It is what happens, you see, when you get things hardened. You harden into a mold is what you do. And so he that will not harden his heart, I mean, you've made up your mind and you won't change it at all, well, that's hardness of heart. You become doctrinaire, you become an ideologue and so forth, he's hardened. The greater portion of the world, until it is given to him, this is an interesting thing to know here. Notice the nice contrast between these verses. Till the greater portion of the world, as he will not harden his heart, is given to him progressively, you see, the greater portion of the world, until it is given unto him to know the mysteries of God, until he know them in full. Now that's progressive knowledge. And notice the next verse reverses that exactly. They that will harden their hearts, to them is given the lesser portion of the word until they know nothing. See, nothing concerning his mysteries. The first, if they don't harden their hearts, they will progress until they know the mysteries in full. The next one, they will get harder and harder and know less and less and less until finally they know nothing at all. It works in the opposite direction. You can't be static. You can't just stay between them. You must make your choice, as Heraclitus says, odos anokatomia. The road upward and the downward road are the same. It depends entirely on the way you're facing. You can't compromise between them. You take the up road or the down road, you see. You can't go off at an angle or anything like that. And it's the same thing here. You'll harden or you'll keep open. Now, this is what is meant by the change of hell. See, he says, I've been using change of hell just as an image here. They're not real change as far as that goes. This is what is meant by the change of hell. Refers to them again in 1330 here. Compared to, yes, that's a very common statement here. So, and then he says, if their hearts were, notice he says, then if our hearts have been hardened, yea, if we have hardened our hearts against the word, then it happens. For our words will condemn us. Notice the three things we can do. There are three things we can produce. Notice the 14th verse here. And all condemn us if we are hardened our hearts and we're controlled and we have no idea of changing or anything like that. We've made up our mind what it is. See, I may be completely wrong now. And everything I say, well, all right, I'm still open. I'll still change. I'm way behind in certain things. But if our hearts are not hardened, our words will condemn us, and our works will condemn us, and our thoughts will condemn us, he says. So these are the three things we can produce. You can produce words, you can produce works, and it all goes back to thoughts, you see. They're the three things that motivate us. And they can all become hardened and conventionalized and in a groove. And in that case, we dare not look up to our God. You can see why. If you get in your cozy shell and so forth, anything outside will terrify you. It's like being in your foxhole. You don't want to get out, and yet you know it's dangerous to stay in. What are you going to do? dare to look at our God. And we'd be glad, notice, we'd be glad if he would command the rocks and the mountains to fall upon us. That's how guilty we feel. We do not want to face up to it. We don't want to get out and get mobile again. Because once you've been frozen in the mold, once you change the custom, it's impossible. It's terrifying, the thought of having to get out and move around in the open. Our own responsibility and awareness of our own potential, you see, we know it. We know it, and when we haven't taken advantage of it, we feel guilty as all get out, and we do not want to look upon. We let the rocks cover us, let the rocks and the mountains fall on us. But, sorry, we're ongoing creatures. You're going to live forever, he says. You can die no more. And so he says, we must come forth and stand before him. You're not going to get out of it, so you might as well get used to it now. You see, that's why to hear the gospel now. And we have to acknowledge, to our everlasting shame, we can't avoid it. Or we can deny that it's all true. We know that's so, see. His power and his majesty and our dominion, and acknowledge our everlasting shame that all his judgments are just. It's ugly. He has all power to save, and he wants to save us, and if we don't take advantage of it, we're going to be very much ashamed of ourselves. So therefore, the subject is repentance. We preach nothing but repentance, he says. Now he says about the second death. The second death is on a different level, just like the morning of the first resurrection is on another level of existence, permanently hereafter, as far as that, the same thing. The second death is when you die as to things pertaining to righteousness. As Macbeth says, the second death, I've stepped in blood so far that should I wade no more, return would be as tedious as go o'er. You reach a point when it's easier just to go ahead with it than go back and try to reform and change things and fix up. You reach that point of return, and that's what happens here. And then you're stuck with it. You're in the second death. You don't want to change. It's the sort of thing that paranoids get and so forth. Die as to things pertaining to righteousness. You're paranoid. That means you go on living, but you'll go on living at another level, and it won't be such a happy one. And eventually, you're going to have to come around anyway, so get that into our thick heads. Now, then, notice their torment shall be as a lake of fire and brimstone. It doesn't believe that literally. They shall be chained down to an everlasting destruction. He just told us what he meant by being chained down, he says. That is what meant by the chains of hell. When you go on until you know nothing, you become completely committed and you can't get out of the hole that you've dug yourself into. 18th verse, notice how strongly he puts it. Satan, having subjected them according to his will, as though there had been no redemption made. That's a terrible doom on you. And there are people like that now, of course, as though there had been no redemption made. But they're stuck with it. Same verse, he says, they cannot die. This is the real stroke of doom here. Not destruction, not death is the stroke of doom, but the fact they can't die, and yet they're living as there had been no redemption. They're going to have to go through an awful hell, you see, before they can get out of that. Now, there was one Antoniah who was a chief ruler. He came forth and said to him, now he's indignant, he's had all he can take here, and he said, what is this stuff you're talking about? The soul can never die, he says. Then he tells him about the cherubim and the flaming sword that guarded the tree of life. We're not supposed to touch the tree of life, lest Adam partake of the tree of life and live forever in his sins. So he says, we can die. This idea of saying we can't die, we're not supposed to eat the tree of life, and we're forbidden to touch it at all. So that settles that. Yeah. Partake of the tree of life and live forever? No. Thus we see there's no possible chance that we should live forever, because the tree was set up there that we couldn't eat from it. If we had eaten from it, then we'd live forever. He says, no, there's to be no tree. So we thought that was a good argument. And Alma says, that's all right for now. All mankind became lost and fallen people. They did, and that's true. They couldn't go on living that way. That's the whole point, living in the sewer, you see, as far as that goes. We see that death comes upon mankind, a temporal death, and that's real, you see, and there is a space granted that we might repent, we're here for. Therefore, a very important verse here, this 24th. This life became a probationary state, and we are being tested every minute of the day by the choices we make, by the reactions we make, by the things we say, by the things we think about, every moment. Like the two ways, the ancient Christian doctrine of the two ways, the way to the right and the way to the left, and whichever they are, you see. But you must make the choice, and you may have made the wrong choice every day of your life up until now, but it's, as long as you're here, it's still not too late. You can still make the right choice. Every minute you can make the right choice. It's never too late to make the right one. You make the wrong one, that happens too. So here, then we'll have a time to repent. Therefore, this life became a probationary state. Well, it can't be anything else, you see, a time to prepare to meet God, a time to prepare. That's why we need the gospel here, you see. We're assured of our resurrection. That's all very well taken care of. But how do we prepare for the long stretch ahead? That's what we're doing here, you see. Prepare to meet God. Prepare for that endless state which has been spoken of by us, which is the resurrection. Now, if it had not been for the plan, now, this is the doctrine of the preexistence. Oh, the time is up now, because I was going to talk about the Christian doctrine. The only alternative to preexistence, see, is predestination. We'll talk about that next time. Had been not for the plan of redemption, which was laid down from the foundation of the world. See, we go right back to the preexistence here. Foundation of the world. The plan was set for redemption, for resurrection. It was already arranged before the foundation of the world that we should come back again, that we should be redeemed, and that resurrection means raised up again, of course. And raised up again. But there was a plan of redemption, which shall bring to pass the resurrection of the dead, which had been spoken. See, that whole thing was planned ahead of time. And it's all, this is the picture. So this whole life, he says, is nothing but a preparation for the next stage. I say, for the long haul ahead. You did pretty well on the one before. And this was the teaching of the ancient Christians. Origen tells us, who is the first best of Christian theologians, he tells us that the brethren, he says what the brethren used to teach in his day, they didn't know what to make of these doctrines, but he says the brethren in the early church used to teach that when we came into this world, before we came into this world, we had to pass examination and test just as we do when we leave this world and hereafter. See, we'll be tested in the judgment. Well, there was a judgment before he came here. That's why the various conditions in which we were born here, says Origen, are not unfair and unjust. Some people are born into a miserable condition. Other people are born in with great advantages and blessings and so forth. In the end, we're all very much alike, though. But he says, nevertheless, this great difference has to do with what some are born, for example, in the church. He says, in that case, it means that they had good marks before they came here. Others got pretty bad marks, so they started at a disadvantage. It's going to be the same after this. If you behave yourself here, this time of probation, then you'll begin with an advantage in the next week. That's why he preached the gospel, because it has an advantage. Therefore, and then he says here in the 26th verse, now before it were possible, our first parents could have put forth their hand and partaken of the tree of life, they would have been forever miserable, having no preparatory state. Too late now, you've partaken of the tree of life, you're going to live forever now, whether you like it or not, in the state you're in now, you see, and live forever in their sins, lest Adam partake of the fruit of the tree of life and live forever in his sins. He's stuck the way he is now. Well, that was not to happen. They mustn't touch the tree of life now. It's too soon. We'll come to that later when you get the tree of life, but not there. So it's become preparatory. Well, it all makes very good sense, and it's the only answer, the only scenario that anyone has ever come up with. The Christians don't have any. When they say it's a mystery, means it's a contradiction. We just don't understand. They won't accept the physical resurrection or the judgment that way. They say it's a spiritual thing and so forth. And what they have now, but they're going to have at Easter, you see, is the great center of Easter is the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. That's where they all go at Easter. That's where they went, where crusaders went, where everybody goes, the Holy Sepulchre. Why go to the sepulchre? Remember when the ladies went to the sepulchre with John, there was an angel there, and he said, what are you looking for him here? Why are you looking for the living among the dead? He is not here, he said. He's risen. He's not here. So what do? We go. As John Chrysostom says, we go so we can view the bloody image of the Lord and see his sufferings and see him on the cross and all that. Well, that's all over with, he said. So we're told that, I say, already in the scriptures where the angel says, he's not here, he's risen. We don't talk about him dead. Christus Anesti is the way the Greeks put it. Everybody says Christus Anesti as far as that goes. But now we're coming to Good Friday, and oh, that's black and terrible. That's a terrible thing we have to go through. It's very ancient, though. It goes back to prehistoric times. And the gospel plan was there too. Well, I see the time is up now, so this next is rather important.